The federal government's recent announcement to phase out private prisons has again launched a debate over the private prison system here in Florida. Good Thursday morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and the WJCT app, and watch the show with video on demand at our partner, TVJax.com. Just ahead, we'll take your calls on the controversy over private prisons. Where do you stand on that? Give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, a recent court case could change the way bail is set for the poor in the U.S., plus YMCA Executive Director Eric Mann and Canines for Warriors, all of that ahead. But first this hour, lots of reaction this week as U.S. Justice Department officials say they will phase out their use of private prisons for federal inmates. In making the decision, Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates cited new findings by the department's inspector general, who reported disturbing incidents of inmate contraband, higher rates of assaults, and more use of force than facilities run by the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Florida has a large network of prisons, both public and private, and over the years, issues from a record number of inmate deaths to claims of prisoner abuse and more have caused concern. So, what does the shift away from prison privatization mean for this state? Former state legislator and columnist Paula Dockery, Republican of Lakeland, has written extensively about problems with Florida's prisons, and she's on the line now. Paula Dockery, a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Melissa. Glad to be with you.
And to our callers, where do you stand on the issue of private prisons? What are your thoughts about this issue as we talk about the federal decision and Florida's issues? Get on the line now, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet us, or weigh in on our Facebook page. Paula Dockery, what is your reaction, first off, to the Justice Department report? It cites both cost and safety concerns at private prisons.
Well, it's good to have a investigation into it and some hard data and facts, because the problem we had in Florida is we couldn't really get good information about how our private prisons were doing. And just to kind of paint the picture for your audience, in the state of Florida, we've consistently had about 100,000 inmates in our adult inmates in our state prison system. That, of course, doesn't include county jails or juvenile facilities. And they're in 56 major institutions, and 7 of those are private. And the private institutions don't have to report as much information to us as the public institutions do. So it's hard to really get to that information about what's going on in those prisons.
And here in Florida, as well as other states, there's been a push toward more privatization. This flies in the face of the Justice Department's push away. So here in Florida, how do you see this playing out? Because on the one hand, federal inmates will be phased out, but though advocates of prison privatization say that private corporations can do this work more cheaply and effectively.
Well, and that's interesting. In 2011 and 2012, my last 2 years in the legislature, and I did serve as criminal justice chairman, so I was intimately familiar with the issue, but still couldn't get good information out of the two departments. There are two separate state agencies handle prisons. The Department of Corrections and then the Department of Management Services oversees the contracts of the 7 private prisons. And in 2011, when it was clear that the votes weren't going to be in the Senate to pass it, the leadership, who was really pushing the issue, put it through the budget, and the courts then threw it out, saying that what they did was unconstitutional. In 2012, it was passed. It would have easily passed through the Florida House, but in the Florida Senate, 9 Republicans joined with all 12 Democrats to defeat the bill, even though it was a major priority of both Governor Scott and both legislative leaders. So there was a lot of political power behind the push for prison privatization, but senators, bipartisan group of senators, stopped it. I was surprised that they haven't brought it back up since 2012, but the prison population has been decreasing. The state has closed 9 state prisons, state-operated prisons, while still continuing to give 10% of our prison population over to the 7 private prisons to manage.
And as we speak with former state legislator Paula Dockery about private prisons, we want your calls about this. We'll go to the phones in a moment at 549-2937. And Paula Dockery, as you've written about, this is really a fraction of all of the prisoners in the nation. Initially, privatization became an answer to swelling prison populations, promising mainly cost savings. Critics of that trend say that putting the profit motive behind incarceration always begs the need for more customers or more business, which is people being put in prison. They say that it has led to the criminalization of minor infractions and such. But on the other hand, over-incarceration in general has been an issue both in public and private prisons. So as criminal justice reform continues to be more and more of an issue in this country, how do you see that being applied in the Sunshine State, trying to apply what people might call smart justice principles to our system in Florida?
Right. We went through a period in Florida and probably many other states where we kept making new things from misdemeanors into felonies. We elongated sentences to build up the prison privatization under the guise of tough on crime. Come to find out that some of these private prison firms were lobbying for a lot of this increased penalty. So the profit motive, which is great in private industry, It runs counterproductive to what we in the state are trying to do. For example, we would love when people get released from prison after they serve their time that they become productive citizens, and we hope that the recidivism rate is low. And one of the ways we can do that is through programs, such as addiction programs or job training, and then we hope we don't see them back in the prison system. The for-profit prisons have the exact opposite goal. They would like to see more people come back in the prisons. And so when the prison population is decreasing, sometimes, and we did this in Florida, which is beyond belief, we write into their contract that we guarantee them 90% occupancy, even if they don't have it. So that diminishes their need to push for changes in law to make sure their beds stay full, because we're going to pay them whether they have people or not. So it's hard to understand where the savings is. I don't think there is savings. When we question those pushing prison privatization about those savings, they say, well, it's guaranteed in the contract that they'll save 7%. But when you dig into the details, 7% over what? And it depends on which prison they compare them to. Is it a similar population? For instance, younger inmates are less expensive, healthy inmates are less expensive, nonviolent inmates are less expensive. So if they're cherry picking the easiest, cheapest inmates and comparing them to a prison that has more issues with health care and riots and gang activity and contraband and whatnot, then it's going to look like they're saving money. But then we may give a prison that only has 30% occupancy per diem rates for 90% occupancy. So there's a lot there that we couldn't really get to. But the fact is that prisons are one of the state's major responsibilities for safety and security, and that's not something we should be outsourcing to the private industry, because their goals and our goals are so diametrically opposed.
And right now we're going to go to your calls for former state legislator Paula Dockery as the U.S. Justice Department shifts away from private prisons. What are your questions about Florida's system of corrections? It's 549-2937. To call into the show, Tom on the West Side. Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Yeah, you've already covered several of the things I wanted to mention, especially about their vested interest in recidivism. But the other point is they have absolutely no incentive to follow any kind of progressive reform program that might reduce recidivism, because, one, we know that they benefit from recidivism, and two, any reform program that might reduce crime is going to be costly, and they have a further disincentive to follow that.
So it's all about the money, Paula Dockery. Thanks for the call, Tom. Do you agree with that? When it comes to criminal justice reform, trying to reduce the cost of incarceration, you know, by changing sentencing laws, reducing the use of mandatory minimums, more resources for addiction treatment, job training and such. What about that caller's question? And where do you think Florida could be doing better?
Oh, he's absolutely on target. And the smart justice reforms are something Florida really needs to start adopting. We tried several times, and the legislation for smart justice reforms, especially reducing mandatory minimums or getting rid of them and giving discretion back to the judges, passed the Senate, but we could not get them through the House. And I don't see that changing in the future. But what's interesting is the people nationally who are involved in these smart justice reforms is one of those strange bedfellow groups. You've got the Koch brothers, very far on the right. You've got Grover Norquist approaching it from a tax perspective, how our tax dollars can be better spent. You've got the Obama administration. So you've got this, and you've got clergy from all over, especially the Catholic bishops. So you've got this group of people making a great case from a money perspective, from an ethical perspective, from a what we did caused a lot of unintended consequences, let's address the problems. And other states are adopting this and having even states like Texas, who you couldn't argue is a liberal state, is having great success with it. So Florida really needs to get on board. The other issue we need to address is not putting our mentally ill in the prison system. The prison personnel is not trained or prepared to handle them. They're not getting the medical help that they need. It serves nobody well, and it's more expensive to keep somebody incarcerated in a state prison. For those who don't know, it's about $20,000 a year. We have people in prison for 3 to 5 years who are driving on a suspended driver's license when the underlying reason for the license being suspended was failure to pay a fee or fine. So it's almost become a debtor's prison, and instead of helping them get on their feet to repaying that fine or putting them in a work camp, we're charging Florida taxpayers $20,000 a year to incarcerate them. They may be the breadwinner in the family. Now the family may be accessing state support, and they're missing their loved one and missing the income going into that family. So we've got a lot of things that don't make sense, and that person is no danger to society. And in prison for several years, they're going to become unemployable when they get out. So we just need to look at things better. But I think the one thing that will have the most impact is returning discretion to judges. That's their job. Every case is different, and they are intimately familiar with the details and can make a better judgment about what time served is the correct punishment.
And as we continue to talk about how that could be accomplished, we're going to take some more calls for former state legislator Paula Dockery, Republican of Lakeland and columnist in Florida, as we look at the issue of private prisons. As the federal government says it will phase out using them, we want to know what you think about the prison system in Florida. It's 549-2937. Chuck is at the beaches. Hey, Chuck, you're on the air.
Hello, guys.
Hey.
You're talking about whether it was public or private. I would think it would depend on what the contract is, whether the public or the private. And you mentioned mental illness and addiction. That's everywhere, and I don't understand why the legislature or we as a community can't understand and come to that agreement. And then if you're going to write the contract for the public or you're going to write the contract for the state prisons, you have to have a goal. And let me give you an example. Fletcher High School, Seabreeze Elementary, they get graded on how they do. And if you get a bad grade and you're the principal, you might be gone. And perhaps maybe you should have some citizens and some civilians on a board grading these prisons and these people, and maybe some people should be losing their jobs. Thanks for letting me share.
Appreciate All right. It. Thanks, Chuck. Paula Dockery.
Yeah, we do have prison monitors. I don't know that that's been particularly effective. I think there are some faults within the system that don't allow them to to really be impactful on what our actions towards the prisons are. But I'm kind of lost a little bit on what he was saying with the contract. The keep something in mind. We use the word privatization, but really what we're doing is outsourcing, because taxpayers are still paying for private corporations to run public prisons. State prisons are still public prisons. They're just privately managed. And another point that hasn't been touched on yet is when Governor Scott came into office, and I'm going to be pretty tough on him because I think he's done a terrible job with the Department of Corrections and our prison system. In the 6 years he's been in office, he's been through four Department of Corrections secretaries. And there's been, as the Miami Herald has done a great investigative series on this, there's been many prison deaths. We have prison investigators who have pointed out corruption in prison. They get demoted. The people who they are accusing of doing the corruption get promoted. So there's some really bad stuff happening in our prison system, public and private. So I can't say that the private prisons are being run any worse than the public right now, because we have major problems in our correction system, and it really needs to be cleaned up. And when he brought the newest Department of Correction Secretary on board, Julie Jones, I had high hopes for her because she had done well in heading up two other state agencies in the past. But it all comes down to the man on top and where his priorities are and where his funding priorities are. And she requested more money, more personnel, more training. The governor's office said not needed, and then she kind of retracted her statement. So if the governor were to allow somebody to really have the tools necessary to clean up the prison system, we can. So I just want to be clear that even though I think prison privatization is wrong for Florida, we certainly shouldn't expand it to more prisons. But I would like to see us phase out all of them as our prison population declines. And when and if we finally implement smart justice reforms, that population will probably decline a little further.
549-2937, calls from all over the area. Robert in Middleburg. Hey, Robert. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Great, thanks.
I'm calling to ask, before the privatization was allowed, there had to have been a case study and research done. So knowing that it's being private, that there was going to be an incentive for people to make money in privatization, did that entail create the incentive to incarcerate more people, which Ms. Dargety, and forgive me if I pronounced the last name wrong, stated earlier? So then with that being said and all of this coming out, what happens to these people who have become a victim of that irrational or illegal incarceration? That's my question.
Yeah, thanks, Robert. Paula, what about that?
I was having a tough time understanding or hearing what he was saying.
When you talked about how some Florida prisons have almost become debtors' prisons with either illegal incarceration or over-incarceration, how do we get to this place?
Yeah, well, you know, there are different stories behind each of the laws that we passed. There was a time when, in the 90s, when crime rates were so high that the public was demanding tough on crime measures, and that led to some bills passing that took away discretion from judges and just did a one size fits all. And when you sit through a court case and listen to individual facts, even though the crime may have been the same with two different cases, the extenuating circumstances are so different that the same sentence doesn't really make sense. So I don't know how you go about changing that. I've heard of judges in many instances say, I am required by law to give this sentence of 20 years, and I'm sick by it because this person doesn't deserve that much time. And I'll give you a perfect example. And I think some of them fell under the 10-20 life law that we passed. So you could actually get 20 years even though there was no violence involved. And one of the perfect examples happened in Polk County, where I'm from, and that was a man in his own home shot his gun in the air, in the direction of, but not close enough to, her his daughter's boyfriend who was beating her. Mm. He's in prison for 20 years. Nobody was hurt. It was in his own home. The person was beating up on his daughter, and the judge was sick about giving it, but that's what the law prescribed. Those are the things that we need to readdress.
George is in Jacksonville. Hi, George.
Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Go ahead.
I just want to start a suit a little bit. I don't remember the name of the fellow that lost the private prison, the head guy of that company. But I don't know about the last election, but Mr. Scott's first election, they donated $2 million to us. So I don't know if that would make Governor Scott move forward or not.
Okay, yeah. And it's not a real good connection, George, but thanks for bringing that up. Paula Dockery, what about lobbying groups and private prison groups like, say, Geo Group? They've given millions to candidates in Florida, both Democrats and Republicans, such as Patrick Murphy, Senator Bill Nelson, Marco Rubio in particular has been given a lot of money. Jeb Bush got money from Geo Group when he was running for president. They've spread a lot of money around and have had, as you've written, an outsized influence on this debate. What are your thoughts about that part of the issue?
I think they've gotten a good return on their investment. Unfortunately, that's not what's in the best interest of taxpayers, and it's not what's in the best interest of our criminal justice system. But that is, unfortunately, how the process works. What's really disturbing about it is that the money we're paying them allows them to have the money to then lobby against what's in the state's best interest, and to give campaign contributions, not just a $500 contribution or whatever the maximum is at the federal level, I think it's $2,700, but big money to Rick Scott's PAC, Let's Get to Work, to the parties. And so they do invest heavily in the political leadership, and it pays off. And that's why the vote in 2012 was really noteworthy. You have the Senate president, who's a Republican, the Speaker of the House, who's Republican, and the governor, who is Republican, all pushing for prison privatization, and it was killed in the Senate with 9 Republicans joining with all 12 Democrats to defeat it on a 19 yes, 21 no vote. And that was just shocking. Usually when bills make it to the floor, leadership has a good idea that they're going to pass, because it's very embarrassing for them if it doesn't. And at one point, we had 23 no votes, but they pounded on people to get them to change their votes. And leadership holds all the cards. They can take away your chairmanship, which they did. They took away mine. They took away Mike Fasano's, who was criminal justice appropriations chair. They can take away an appropriation, they can hold up your bills from being heard. So generally people go along with leadership because they want to be effective in the process. So it's not worth, you know, risking your entire career or political effectiveness or even your next reelection. But this many people felt that strongly on this issue that they did it.
What are your final thoughts then about where this issue goes from here in Florida?
You know, it would be interesting to see if the legislature brings it back up, because the impetus for prison privatization coming in to its own was because there was overcrowding, and it was a quick answer to how do we manage our prison system when we have too many people for the buildings that we have. Now that the prison population is decreasing, and that was part of the rationale under the federal government's decision. And keep in mind, the federal government didn't rule out all private prisons just in their Department of Justice, which is their inmates, but it doesn't include the U.S. Marshal or the Immigration Service, which does a lot of detention and holding. So these big corporations, which is only about three of the largest, that are going to see that market share drop, but not by much, because they still have the state. They still, although some other states have been pulling back as well, like Kentucky, Colorado. So they're going to be looking to make up that market share. And I think they look at Florida as a prime target because they have, you know, friends in political leadership. But it would be very hard for the legislature to justify it when the prison population is going down and when we've closed 9 state prisons, but yet we keep sending more inmates to these private prisons.
Always good to talk to you. Thanks for being on the line with us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
She's former state legislator Paula Dockery, Republican of Lakeland, and columnist as we discuss the issue of private prisons. And much more still ahead. Later, a look inside this area's new YMCA. But up next, how a little-discussed court case in Georgia could end bail for the accused. That's next.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Donald Trump lays out a plan for immigration after a meeting with the president of Mexico. An update on the Republican presidential nominee's proposals on immigration, illegal drugs, and trade.
Weekdays at 10, right after First Coast Connect on 89.9 FM WJCT.
Every child deserves a champion, an adult who will never give up on them, who understands the power of connection and insists that they become the best they can possibly be. Join WJCT as we honor our 2016 American Graduate Champions of the First Coast, men and women who commit their time, skills, and resources to make sure that young people succeed and play an active role in improving educational outcomes for all students. Thursday, September 15th, 6 p.m. at the WJCT studios. Tickets are $40. WJCT.org/events.
Classical music is available 22 hours a day on WJCT 89.9 FM HD2. Find out how you can listen to classical music by calling 358-6390. Enjoy classical music day or night on 89.9 HD2.
Welcome back. Well, a federal court case in Georgia is examining if it's unconstitutional to set bail at a cost that a poor defendant cannot afford. The case Maurice Walker versus the city of Calhoun, Georgia, was in the U.S. 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. And depending on how this goes, it could throw out our current bail system in these United States. We learned about this from Jeff Clayton, policy director of the American Bail Coalition. Let's listen. Jeff Clayton, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
This has sort of flown under the radar, but this Georgia federal case could be hugely impactful when it comes to the U.S. bail system. Can you tell us a little bit about the case?
Absolutely. And you're right. The case could eliminate all monetary conditions of bail in the country. The case is about a guy named Maurice Walker who was intoxicated in public and was arrested and argued that he couldn't afford his bail and he had to wait too long. And because he was poor, it violated the Equal Protection and Due Process Clauses of the U.S. Constitution.
Why is this case in particular the one that could be the linchpin for remaking America's bail system?
Well, as you saw about 2 weeks ago, or I believe it was last week, the U.S. Justice Department intervened in this case, filed a brief in support of the plaintiffs. This is the first of a series of cases that really were kicked off when Eric Holder was Attorney General and intervened in a case in 2015. This is the first one to reach a circuit court of appeals, which is one level below the U.S. Supreme Court. So we're getting a test of this theory, and this is pretty much the first one.
And former Attorney General Holder is certainly a major factor into how this has worked its way through the legal system. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. The first case was filed in Clanton, Alabama, at the tail end of January of 2015. And at the time, Eric Holder filed a petition to intervene and filed a brief in the case in support of the plaintiffs. And the theory was very similar. It was a very similarly situated case. And since then, and the plaintiff's attorneys will tell you, it sort of kicked off a movement of these cases, and I believe 15 have now been filed across the country.
What about the arguments that this could be a slippery slope to chaos, that if commercial bail were eliminated, there could be threats to public safety?
Well, if there's no monetary bail and in lieu of posting it can serve as a basis to keep someone in jail, the system you have is what I call a bipolar system of bail, where someone is either held indefinitely pending trial with no bail or released. And the problem there is it's expensive because the prosecutor is going to have to prove it every time that the person's dangerous. So the chaos issue is, you know, can localities afford this system, and will they be able to implement all the aspects of this system in order to make it work? Because, it does work in at least two jurisdictions, but it's hugely expensive.
And where do you see this case going? Could this make its way to the Supreme Court?
I think so. It certainly depends on how it turns out in the 11th Circuit. There's two other cases. Actually, there's three others, two out in California, one in San Francisco, one in Sacramento. And then there's two companion cases going in Houston right now. So I think one of the three has definitely the potential to make it. And certainly this would be the first one if it goes the wrong way and somebody applies for cert.
And assuming that the bail system, as we understand it today, is thrown out, what will replace it? What would you envision as the new framework for this?
It would be the District of Columbia or federal systems where money is primarily not used. And as I mentioned, there's problems with that. In the federal system, they incarcerate 64% of all defendants with no bail, which localities can't do. The D.C. system costs $65 million dollars annually, which most local jurisdictions don't have, to both evaluate and then supervise people instead of having the accountability that a bail bond brings. So they're actually sort of on a form of probation as an alternative. So that's where I think they're going to go. I'm just not sure that, you know, states and localities around the country can afford that model.
We'll have to watch it. In the meantime, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
That was Jeff Clayton, Policy Director of the American Bail Coalition. Back in a moment.
On the next Fresh Air, our series of favorite recent interviews continues with Sarah Paulson. She's nominated for an Emmy for her performance as prosecutor Marsha Clark in the FX series The People vs. O.J. Simpson.
The O.J. Simpson you've never met. The face of a batterer, the abuser, the murderer.
Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Do you have music you want people to hear? Do you have an artistic vision you want to share? Then join these winners in The Square. The Square is an online venue where artists share their work with the community and compete for a chance to be featured on WJCT-TV and radio. Submit your work now through September 30th. To learn more about The Square and to submit your work, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
Presenting Next Avenue, the website from WJCT created specifically for adults discovering life after 50. Visit us at wjct.org/nextavenue. It's where grown-ups keep growing. Sponsored in part by AARP. Real possibilities.
Welcome back. Well, it's a truly sobering statistic. Every day in America, 22 veterans commit suicide. This suicide crisis among our men and women in uniform stems from post-traumatic stress, brain injuries suffered in combat, and sometimes trauma suffered from a sexual assault. The local organization, Canines for Warriors, works to treat these veterans with service dogs, a very healing form of therapy. It's part of their national Stop 22 campaign. Rory Diamond is executive director of Canines for Warriors, and he's also a city councilman-elect in Neptune Beach. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Good to talk to you. And Stop 22 refers to the 22 veteran suicides every day. This is a crisis. You've testified before Congress on this issue, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, during the course of your show, statistically speaking, some veteran in America is going to commit suicide, and it's out of control, and the government's response is woefully inept.
And how do you feel that to be? In what way should the government be doing more to help veterans who served?
So our veterans typically only have one access to healthcare, and that's the VA system. And repeatedly, they're going to the VA to get mental health services, and either they're being told to wait weeks, if not months, or they're simply being given inadequate services. I mean, the government's response is three things: pills, pills, and more pills.
Yeah. So that's where Canines for Warriors has entered the picture. It's such an interesting way to provide therapeutic support, working with dogs. Can you tell us how this all got started and how it has helped so many veterans, not just in this area, but in plenty of other places around the country?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our heart is with Sherry Duvall, our founder and president. Her son, Brett, did two tours of Iraq as a bomb dog handler. And when he came home the second time, she had already started Canines for Warriors. And that was the plan. And she is the mom for the whole staff and all 250 of our graduates.
How does it work with the dogs? Do you pick a dog, you pair a dog with a veteran? How does that whole process come about?
So we do things kind of uniquely. So we use rescue dogs instead of puppy breeding programs. So we scour the whole country looking for rescue dogs. We bring them to our campus and train them. And then the warriors come down and we try to pair them up with activity levels and family situations and allergies and all these other, you know, little ingredients. It's a lot like a dating app. You know, we kind of got to piece them together correctly, and then it usually works.
And how do the dogs help heal?
I wish I had the right answer to that question, but they do. For example, 92% of our warriors that we get have a severe suicidal ideation. And within 6 months of getting the dog, it goes down to 14%. So we know that it's working, but exactly how that connection, that bond is changing the warrior's brain, we don't quite know yet.
Isn't that amazing, though?
It's incredible to see. I got a text message last night from one of our warriors who said he was on the border of suicide, had made two attempts before he came to Canines. He told me today that he has not had a thought like that since.
And the goal is to help veterans return to civilian life with dignity, with independence, and mentally strong.
Absolutely.
That's always the goal.
Yeah, and not just to stay alive, because veteran suicide is a huge problem, but to get back out into the world. Our warriors are hiding at home. They're not being good moms and dads. They're not going to work. Many of them can't even go to school, but we're getting back out into the world, and that's what the dog does. It's a bridge back into the world again.
Got to walk that dog.
Yeah, absolutely. Every morning.
That's right. And it's good for the dogs, too, which that's what the brilliance of this whole concept is. These are rescue dogs. They need a home. They need someone to love them.
Absolutely. What we say is we rescue the dog, and the dog rescues the warrior. And you get to meet these dogs and meet these warriors and see how that bond is completely changing both of their lives. And you realize this is transformative.
How can people help Canines for Warriors?
You certainly go to our website, caninesforwarriors.org, or to focus more on veteran suicide, we have Stop 22, that's STOP22.org, and learn about what's going on. If nothing else, let's talk about veteran suicide. Let's talk about PTSD and raise awareness.
Yes. And again, it's caninesforwarriors.org. The Stop 22 campaign refers to the 22 veteran suicides every day in this country. If you'd like to help them, get in touch with them. If you're a veteran and this is the first you're hearing about this, or have a loved one who's a veteran, get in touch with Canines for Warriors, a national organization but based in Ponte Vedra.
Absolutely.
He's Rory Diamond, executive director of Canines for Warriors and a city councilman in Neptune Beach. Good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
September is National Preparedness Month. Are you, Jax, ready? Learn more about how you can keep yourselves and your family safe during a storm. Download the 2016-2017 City of Jacksonville Preparedness Guide today at jacksready.com and tune in to 89.9, the area's official emergency broadcast station.
This segment is brought to you by Colo CSX Data Center Hosting Solutions.
Hi, I'm Tom Clark.
And I'm Zorba Pastor.
Join us each week for the most upbeat hour in healthy living.
It'll be as irreverent as it is informative.
We always have a great time. So will you on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sundays at 5 on 89.9 WJCT.
If you're looking for the best blues show, look to the Blues Horizon. Each week, join me for the best blues, both classic and contemporary. Blues Horizon, every Monday night at 11 p.m. on WJCT 89.9 FM radio. Take a ride with us to some unknown places of musical light and shade. Blues Horizon, every Monday night at 11 on 89.9 FM. So many roads.
Unlock your newest member benefit. Over 1,000 episodes of your favorite PBS shows. American Masters. Antiques Roadshow. Nature. Nova. Masterpiece. Watch the best of PBS anytime, anywhere. Become a member. Sign in and start streaming today.
WJCT.org/passport.
Welcome back. Well, if you love Instagram and WJCT, show us when you post your Instagram photos this week. Use the hashtag #ILoveWJCT. We'll pick our favorite and publish it Friday in our First Read e-newsletter. You can subscribe to that by going to WJCTnews.org. And finally, this hour, it's part of this city's downtown renaissance. The new Winston YMCA is officially open to much fanfare on Riverside Avenue, and it's also the first healthy living center in downtown Jacksonville, replacing the old Yates YMCA. But the new Y is much more than just a gym. YMCA President and CEO Eric Mann joins us now with more about that. And good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being here. And it's a pretty big deal when this new facility opened, a gorgeous facility on the St. Johns River North Bank. Lots of excitement about this. Why do you feel this is such a big step forward in this area in a number of ways? Downtown development, public health, business development. There's a lot happening with this building.
Well, the YMCA has been in this community for over 108 years, and at that location since 1954. And so the Y is an institution in Jacksonville and been a part of the growth of Jacksonville. And so we're very excited to be a part of the next generation, the next renaissance of Jacksonville as well. And so we are excited about what it means to the community.
I need to disclose I am a member. I joined right before you moved to the new building. I thought that would be good timing. And what a building it is. 72,000 square feet with incredible river views, state-of-the-art facility. This was a long time in the coming, wasn't it?
Yes, I think I came in 11, but I think it probably was in the works for about 15 years in terms of having the idea about replacing our Yates Y, because it had been there since 1954.
Yeah, an older building, and certainly one that a lot of people over the years really loved and took advantage of, but times change.
It was time for something new.
Yeah.
Exactly. We have members who have been members of that Y since the beginning. They were 7 years old when they first, and they're still members. And so it is, but it was time. It's time for the next iteration of the Y in downtown Jacksonville.
And this is a great place to work out and go to fitness classes, but you also are, as part of your strategic efforts, using this new facility as a healthy living center to work on chronic illnesses in this area like cancer, stroke, heart disease, and diabetes. Mm-hmm. How is that going to be accomplished?
Well, through our partners. And if you really look at wellness and the total concept of wellness, and that's our goal, is to be a total wellness resource to the community, we knew that we needed to have partners who were experts in the from the medical side. And so we're very fortunate to have a strong medical community and strong partnerships with Baptists, with Florida Blue, and Brooks Rehab.
They're all in the building, and you don't have to join the Y, is that right, to come and visit this Healthy Living Center?
Correct. It's open to the public. You can come in and get questions answered about your health. And afterwards, we hope that you come and visit us and have a place that, if you think about it, if you're talking about wellness, you get good information, and then we have programs that help you implement and to help you reach your goals.
What are some of the most popular programs?
Well, it depends on what you like to do, but obviously group exercise is very popular. We have over 180 classes a week, so from yoga to Zumba to body attack to water aerobics, water Zumba, just laps, running. I mean, you name it, treadmill if you're interested in running, cycling classes. So we have really what you're looking for to help you reach your goals.
But in terms of moving the needle on public health issues in this area, in these zip codes, in and around downtown Jacksonville, obviously diet and exercise are part of it. But that's just a piece of the puzzle of wellness. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, for instance, diabetes and folks who are predisposed to diabetes, that number is critical. And so if you can, you can ward off diabetes by just changing your eating habits. And so we have a diabetes prevention program that we go out into the community, or we do it at the Y, that can save. If you really want, if you're talking about numbers, it costs a company $7,000 when someone has diabetes. Mm-hmm. Our pre-diabetes program costs maybe $500, and it works. And so that's really what it's about, whether it's hypertension, whether it's stroke rehab, it's nutrition. We have coaches who are professionals, dietitians and nutritionists. But our partners, for instance, Baptist has cardiovascular programs for women that, you know, people don't understand that heart disease starts earlier in women, like 18. And so understanding that and having programs that address those kinds of issues are very important to the overall health. And so it's not, you know, wellness is, fitness is a piece, nutrition is a piece, but education is part of it as well.
Sure. The other thing that's exciting about the new Winston Y, I think, is that in addition to serving as a wellness center, it's part of this really exciting renaissance just west of downtown in that Brooklyn corridor on Riverside Avenue, where so much new development has sprung up. Mm-hmm. Brand new glittering building on the riverfront, and the old building, the Yates Y, will be torn down, correct?
Correct.
So what's the fate of that parcel? I think a lot of people are curious to know what's going to be done to develop that piece of land right behind your new facility.
Well, initially, you're right, demolition starts here in a few weeks, but initially it will be parking. But I think over the next couple of years, we will be looking at how can we continue to develop Riverside. And so, and to be a partner in that. So at this point, it'll be parking, but my anticipation is over the next couple of years, there will be some type of development that will complement and enhance, continue to enhance Riverside and Brooklyn.
We'll have to keep our eye on that. In the meantime, a pleasure to be with you, and congratulations on the successful new launch of the Winston YMCA. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome, and I, again, invite the community to come and join.
He is YMCA President and CEO Eric Mann, and that's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes or the WJCT app, and watch the show now, too, with video on demand at our partner, tvjax.com. Next on Diane Rehm, Donald Trump lays out a plan for immigration after a meeting with Mexico's president. An update on the Republican nominee's proposals on immigration, illegal drugs, and trade. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow for our Friday Media Roundtable. Stay dry out there as Tropical Storm Hermine bears down on us tonight and overnight. We'll have live and recorded weather reports throughout the day here on 89.9 and see you at 9 a.m. on the show tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.